And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's that time again, that wonderful time again, to be welcoming back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, who joins us once a month to offer his thoughts on. He has written the book After the Cold War, and his expertise is renowned, and I'm very, very excited about every opportunity I have to talk with him. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Greg, in part because of
this recent column focuses on an incredibly important landmark in 20th century history, the 80th anniversary. You wrote about it on this occasion and have written about it in the past.
Yeah.
Is because it is something that is easy sense obscures just what was accomplished. So I suspect one of the reasons you like to write about it is to, in a sense, really clarify the record about what this undertaking was all about. I mean, what it meant and the enormous scale that was involved. It's really hard to fathom that, especially once 80 years have elapsed.
In my mind, I don't know about you or any of our listeners, I have great difficulty conceiving of that. An important part of military history, and for that matter, the present, is maps. And it's a little hard for me to grasp just how big it was.
One of the things you
and how terrifying it must have been, excuse me, for a lot of those, you know, and other countries. It was a truly international group. But the sense of being exposed and heading into you didn't know what was going to happen, except it was very dangerous. And on Omaha Beach especially, of course, as I think people are generally aware, turned out to be truly a bloodbath before we got ashore and grasped the beaches.
Right. One of the things you say in your column is that Mindy ultimately being successful. Tell us more about why this was so significant.
Eisenhower was convinced that if we didn't literally obliterate transportation routes to the front, that the German army stood a very good chance of defeating the invasion. Fortunately, there was a good deal of debate between Erwin Rommel, who was in charge of the fortifications at the beach, very legendary, very famous German military commander, and another general, I think von Rundstedt, who wound up being the, he got Hitler fired him a couple times, but I believe he was in command at the end of the war. Von Rundstedt believed that once the Allies got ashore, the Germans would be in a very good position to create heavy casualties and defeat the invasion. Rommel was convinced that you had to defeat it on the beaches. And Hitler, the absolute dictator, curiously enough, he would often split the difference. And frequently he'd try not to directly overrule. Eisenhower had two children, one of whom died tragically very, very young. John Eisenhower had a full and successful life, and I've always admired him. It's not easy being the son of any celebrity, and given Eisenhower's almost unique status with the Americans and everybody else, he became a general officer on merit, and he also was a successful author and, I believe, insurance executive in Europe.
Ability in supervising the enormous planning, and he showed great interpersonal skill in that welded and held together the most diverse military alliance in history.
Yeah, it was gigantic.
Tell us more about what made this military alliance, in a sense, so problematic. I mean, that is so diverse. I mean,
called prickly, really insecure leader of the Free French. And the resistance to the Vichy and Nazi regime in France. And de Gaulle, without hesitation, and it was his country and his countrymen, he said, the general's absolutely right. We've got to do this, or we may well fail.
Hmm. One of the things you say about Eisenhower, too, you say he remarkably was able to establish overall unity of command.
Yes.
Explain what you mean by that and what the, and sort of contrast that with the way command sometimes functioned, and the way in which Eisenhower's approach to command was a more united kind of command.
He had to deal with a wide range of nationalities. Our British friends, and it's always tough working with close allies. They could be particularly challenging, and often had a very different view of tactics and strategy. A big part of Eisenhower's job was listening to Churchill. He tried very hard to avoid direct confrontation, but there were lots of disagreements between the great British leader and the Americans, in particular Chief of Staff George Marshall. And he had the Free French and Poles and Dutch and Danes and lots of different Canadians, different nationalities in exile, plus the most visible allies. And he was able to get it all to work. He also was able to develop a good in the West, as well as in Russia. I haven't found this in any books, because along with the great courage of the Soviet people, he said, no matter how skeptical we were, whenever Eisenhower told us, and he always told us in detail, what weapons, supplies, food, ammunition, medical equipment would arrive, it always...
Mr. Khrushchev's visit, his time at Carthage included a visit to the morning show.
Yes.
It was in our old studios, and
yes.
And I cherished the opportunity, the privilege of interviewing him about his really great book. And
well, thank you for remembering that, because you're interviewing.
He is made inaccessible, and so these incredibly dangerous flights were made. And as I was telling you about the book, you immediately popped up with the famous nickname for this perilous stretch, the hump.
The
yes,
hump.
Flying over the hump.
Very dangerous, very difficult. Nationalist Chinese Army was not particularly effective, and Mao Zedong's communists, I believe, pretty much set out the war, but the vast bulk of the Japanese Imperial Army was in China. So supplying our allies in China was crucial. Corruption was rife, which meant that you really had to get a lot of supplies over there for at least some of them to arrive to help the common soldier doing really difficult work in combat. Robert McNamara, speaking of the 60s, made his name as an Army Air Corps officer who was so gifted at statistical analysis, along with a small team around him, that he was able to get maximum payload, maximum range in these supply planes that were crucial to the effort. Without exception, it was really a crucial effort, and supplies and logistics. The cliche is armchair generals to spend an awful lot of time, most of it, on logistics, supply, the details,
right,
especially in an industrial age army.
Sure. And it's the kind of thing that doesn't get shown in movies, or war movies, but it's so, and most of us have so little understanding of that. I wanted to just mention that in Carolyn Alexander's book, one of the things she mentions is that valuable lessons about this, and I'm sure in part the efforts of McNamara decades later with the, or not that long, that much later, but the Berlin airlift.
Ah,
of airlifting supplies into Berlin, and that many of the difficult lessons learned in this theater that being valuable in that really complicated effort.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. With English professor at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, B.J. Hollers, his book called Wisconsin for Kennedy, which tells the really interesting story of John F. Kennedy's efforts in the Wisconsin presidential run to be the Democratic candidate, and ultimately, of course, successful in that year's presidential election. But it's quite a story, and I guess in particular, I never really appreciated until I read this book how John F. Kennedy was really on foreign soil when he entered, you know, the small towns of Wisconsin. I mean, this guy from New England, who had, in a sense, very little in common with most of the people he was talking to in Wisconsin, and what it took for him to connect with as much of the public in Wisconsin as he managed to, it's an accomplishment that should not be underestimated.
That's right. And it was an important time of change. If the 50s are defined in important ways by stability, and I think that's true, the 60s were a really transitional time, and JFK was an important transitional figure. Primaries were not crucial to nominating presidential candidates. They could be important, but there were only about 12 or 15 of them. He and his extremely efficient organization decided to contest only about seven. A lot of primaries were kind of pro forma deals where who was busy visiting the bosses and doing deals and doing all kinds of things while Jack was in the media that were much more important to nominating a candidate. By the end of the 60s and into the 70s, primaries, of course, had become crucial and vital. And the old-fashioned brokered convention has faded. It's really an extremely important transition that ought to be discussed.
Jerry Bruno, this forklift operator from Kenosha with a ninth-grade education, who becomes CB on the rough edges.
On the anecdote front, the human front, I think the book is particularly strong at describing Jerry Bruno and his importance and the interpersonal dimensions of a campaign. You mentioned the Professor Hollers. He's a young English professor, a degree in political science, and the political scientists were not so much have someone who's much more of an historian or much more of a literary analyst than a data-driven.
Right. Well, in talking about people, and this is one thing that ties back to Eisenhower and D-Day, is that a whole lot of success in all kinds of arenas of life.
Of course. Why, Sergey, among other good reasons.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking today with Dr. Art Sear, a monthly visitor to the morning show for many, many years, and I appreciate each and every opportunity we have to talk. I learned so much from your recent column about the most recent local elections in Britain, and you mentioned right at the outset that Americans tend to pay very scant attention to local elections in Britain, and yet they tell a very, very important story. And the big story in Britain is in its most recent elections is the massive gains by the Liberal Democrats and the massive losses by the Conservative Party. I wanted to ask you right off the bat, before we dig into any of those specifics, when we're talking about these parties and what they're named, can we kind of take them at face value? I mean, like, for instance, are the Liberal Democrats, are they liberals in the sense that we use that term here in the United States? And is the Conservative Party, I mean, are they conservative in the way that we think of as conservative? I mean, once in a while, terms like that get bandied about, but they're being used in really different ways. But
yes, to give you a short answer for once, and please don't forget the Labor Party.
Well, right,
which
absolutely
is still the main opposition to the conservatives. There's a really great book by Samuel H. Beer, like the beverage, B-E-E-R, as part of a group, is very different from our own history and society in this country, where we are by definition very, very individual. In graduate school, and we remain good friends, I'm very proud of that, until the end of his life. I had a chance to live in England for about a year when I was working on my PhD dissertation. And one of the things that struck me right away was class consciousness, which had declined dramatically. This was 69-70, compared to what it was like before the war, and has declined further. But there is still a kind of group cohesion and identity to one's group socially and politically that's very different from this country. Nonetheless, especially thanks to Margaret Thatcher, they tend to be a weather vane of what's going to happen nationally. Like here, people don't usually go from local government to national leadership. Hubert Humphrey, the mayor of Minneapolis, is a dramatic exception. But the British system, likewise, it tends to be quite separate from national politics. It's also extremely complicated. And they also reorganize minister, who is a conservative, who's called a general election for July 4th, I believe, a holiday they ignore, I can assure you.
Right.
It's like it doesn't exist over there.
Right.
But, he's a gambling man, so it makes the general election really interesting.
Right.
Clearly, he's a gambler. We'll see what happens.
Right. So one of the things to which you attribute the reversal, the losses for the Conservative Party are what you term as some of the hardships that are part of the fallout from Brexit. And that would be something that they had championed, and now they're kind of living with the consequences of that, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, the country was pretty narrowly divided on Brexit and probably still is. But David Cameron, another Conservative prime minister, decided to have a referendum. That turned out to be a big gamble, which he lost. He wanted to reconfirm their commitment to the Union, and instead a very narrow but clear majority voted to leave the European Union. The British have always been strongly of two minds about the European integration effort. They are living there, again, was a phenomenal. I'm so glad that so many of the students and young, he's erratic, unpredictable, loves the media, and can operate in pretty irresponsible ways. He said, well, what's all these details? I'm a decisive leader. We'll just leave. So they left. And in the wake of that, there have been all kinds of, went back into action just toward the end of my time in Britain many years ago. I worked on the Liberal Party, and I'm now the Liberal Democrats, and I'm very glad to say that you mentioned the Liberal Democrats. They may well get over 40 seats in the next House of Commons.
Hmm.
Yes, so I've been vindicated.
So we'll watch that upcoming national election with
absolutely
great interest.
Also, all these people have titles. Sir Keir, I believe a lawyer, a barrister, became leader of the Labour Party within something like 5 years after really becoming active in politics. Remarkable rise. It's not the way it usually works in Britain.
You frame this as really, really intriguing. Explain the way in which, I mean, I think we can all imagine that brokering this kind of agreement takes plenty of skill, maybe some of the skills we've even already been talking about today.
Yeah.
But explain exactly why this was also a really courageous stand for him to take.
Well, Kevin McCarthy, his predecessor as Speaker, a congressman from California, now leaving the House, Kevin McCarthy, in order to become Speaker only a couple of years ago, agreed the Biden administration very shrewdly organized for him and others became committed to the importance of providing military aid to Ukraine, which the far right is adamantly opposed to in the House, break up a Senate bill that included Ukraine, Israel, and also budget matters, which are a matter of fierce partisanship, into separate bills. Aid to Ukraine did get, the House Republicans basically split to get rid of Mike Johnson. So in point of fact, the far right hates him, but that's only about 25 members of the House, the real beady-eyed zealots. And Johnson has been able to work out partisanship in the House. And perhaps this is a good indicator.
Briefly about these two imposing figures when we look at the history of the U.S. House.
The Speaker of the House used to be a less partisan job. There's a majority leader and whip, minority leader and whip, and then separate from the majority leader and whip is we had a majority in the late 40s and early 50s. And Rayburn was able to really cement this tradition of nonpartisan leadership.
Hmm.
The Republicans finally took over the House in 1990 dramatically and had established, taken advantage of the powers of the presidency to continue his significant legislative success, and Gingrich was sidelined and then retired as Speaker. Gingrich had some personal problems that dogged him as well, but he really personified a very partisan House. I start the column, I think, by quoting Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, "A coward dies 100 times," were both sides he established a kind of dominance in the House that was very comparable to Lyndon Johnson's dominance of the Senate in the 50s. After World War II.
Of what he accomplished in terms of bipartisanship, you say at one point that was not a less partisan time than today.
No.
And I think you're saying that in order for us to fully appreciate what Sam Rayburn accomplished, because it's not that Buddy just got along so easily. Well, then being bipartisan is no accomplishment at all. He accomplished something, but the divisions maybe functioned a little differently or just felt a little different than maybe they do now.
Oh, yeah, and it could become very petty and very personal, even during World War II, when we did have, thank God, a strong sense of national unity. Partisan politics continued. President Roosevelt was bitterly criticized by prominent Republicans for allegedly sending a destroyer back to pick up his dog, Fallow, who had inadvertently been left ashore after some summit meeting. And I don't know if that was true or not, but after, I mean, it really was petty politics. And Roosevelt, brilliant as usual, seized on that to make a major issue of these very personal attacks on my little dog, Fallow. Now, I'm used to this, and certainly my wife is, and our sons are, but Fallow is not. And
quite upset.
He got hilarious responses, but you could picture lots and lots of regular people in America sitting close to their radio listening to the latest on Fallow, who's still struggling to over. He's the Scotty, and he takes money seriously. It's comical, but also it was... there was intensity at the time.
Absolutely. Again and again is the topic of immigration, and not just in our southern states, but even here in Wisconsin. I'm just wondering if you have a brief word of wisdom in terms of how you would have us think about the issue of immigration.
Well, very briefly, I am as part of the run-up to the 1960 campaign. It's a very brief book. It's a great, excellent capsule summary that Senator John Kennedy and his close aide Ted Sorensen produced. A good capsule history of immigration and how vital it's been to the success of our country and how positive it is overall. It's been caught up in current partisanship and the fact that Trump basically came down hard on Republicans in the Congress and told them, I don't want any serious bipartisan legislation passed. They were almost there, but he vetoed it because it is so important for the 24 campaign. Maybe next time we can talk about it more.
You here in our studios, Dr. Art Sear, a monthly visitor to the morning show. I appreciate every opportunity I have to speak with you and look forward to seeing you at some point in the lovely month of June.
Fair enough. It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. It's always nice to be invited back, especially to your show.
Thank you. Tomorrow on the morning show, out of the archives, one of my all-time favorite morning show interviews that concerns the national pastime of baseball. A beautiful book by Sports Illustrated writer S.L. Price called Heart of the Examined, the life and career of a minor league baseball player who... ultimately lost his life when he was struck in the head by a baseball pitch. And the story of that tragedy and the response of minor league baseball to it is the subject of this really lovely book, again called Heart of the Game. Classical music on